Welcome to Homicide: Life on the Set, a podcast about the Emmy Award-winning television show Homicide: Life on the Street, with myself, Chris Carr, and Susan Ingram. On today's podcast, we're joined by Key Grip, Joe Kurtz, and gaffer Josh Spring, and we do a deep dive into the lighting and camera movement on Homicide. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Homicide: Life on the Set. So today we have a very interesting interview with Josh Spring and Joe Kurtz. Josh was the gaffer and Joe was the key grip on Homicide: Life on the Street. And Susan, there may be some members of the audience who don't know what a gaffer or a key grip is, but they are actually integral to the show. They're kind of like one of the many unsung heroes of film and television. So I'll let you explain what a gaffer and a key grip is.
Absolutely. And that's one of the most common questions. I don't get it as much anymore, but a lot, questions that you get. And one of them is when people read the credits, they see key grip, gaffer, and best boy. The gaffer is the head lighting technician and works very closely. Well, they both do, but works very closely with the camera, the cinematographer on the lighting. And the key grip are the crew that build and put everything together. If you're on a soundstage, which we weren't, they would be the guys moving, and women, because there are women grips. Grips would be moving the walls. They're the ones that would build the dolly track, which we didn't have dolly. So Joe's the one who would be putting down the speed rail and the apparatus that Jean would move around on. So they're the sort of the construction fixers. And the key grip would be the leader of that group. And on both sides, lighting and gripping, the best boy would be the second in command.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you for that. This episode is quite technical, but I think it goes into what made Homicide such an innovative show to look at, not just from the lighting point of view, but mainly from the kind of camera movement as well. A lot of very interesting devices were invented specifically on the show to help create that kind of handheld verite look, but to sort of give it a bit more of a cinematic scope than just having a camera on your shoulder.
Right. And because it veered so far from traditional broadcast filmmaking, they were creating things on the fly to see what worked.
Yeah.
Like the chair going down the stairs of our main stairway, and how they built something so that the cameraman could move back and forth in the back seat and get shots of both of the actors in the front seat. There were so many things that they built on the fly to work with that handheld camera that was moving all the time and seeing everything all the time. You know, you'll hear some technical terms like speed rail, B-roll, coupe lights, key lights. Just keep rolling and listening. And in the context of the conversation, you should be able to get a really good feel for what it was like technically to work on the show and all the things that they solved in order to make it work.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Susan. And I hope everybody enjoys this episode, and we will catch you on the other side.
I met you guys probably on a John Waters film before Homicide, but I don't know a whole lot about your before that. I know you worked on other John Waters films. The first John Waters film I worked on was Serial Mom, so I know you guys go back to probably Crybaby. So to give us a little, and whoever wants to start first is fine, give us a little background. How did you get in the film business? And how did you end up on Homicide? Was it something you were recruited for? You know, had you worked with Jean or with the first cameraman who was on the first season? You know, just sort of bring us up to speed.
Sure. My first job was as a projectionist at the Smithsonian. And through that, I met some guys who did live event stuff there. You know, they would do concerts and what have you. And one individual in particular, Bruce Davis, who was a lighting director at this defunct company called City Lights in Washington, D.C., started giving me some part-time work, you know, on the side. And I eventually decided I liked doing that more than running a projector, and went from there to another lighting house. That's how I ended up in grip and electric department. And, you know, as far as Homicide goes, it was Josh who was the original key grip. He recruited me on to be his best boy, which I did for the first two seasons. And then Josh made the miraculous move of going from key grip to gaffer, which was made news in the grip electric world, you know, up and down the East Coast.
Yeah, we'll have to hear about that.
Especially in New York, it really is something that just isn't done. And Jim Finnerty, who was, you know, the executive producer and basically ran the whole show. Their story was that he had basically taken this key grip and made him made him a gaffer. And all the New York guys were like, well, proof that all key grips are capable of just doing everything, which was great. So I had instant credit with the New York guys, and Jim, of course, was elevated even more of a kingmaker, which is pretty funny.
Yeah, there were shockwaves there.
Kingmaker.
And, you know, Jim Finnerty was a renowned key grip, you know, in his day. If you look up his, you know, his filmography, it's amazing, you know.
I think his last film was Platoon with Oliver Stone, and that put him over the edge. He said, enough is enough.
Yeah, he did a lot of huge movies.
Yeah, that's funny. I knew that, and I forgot that. I forgot that that's, yeah, that, that that's, he was, yeah, a, he was a key grip, and also his son, also a renowned grip, right?
The legacy, yeah.
In New York.
So he took special pride in promoting the grip department, over the electricians.
So did you come on season one or two? When did you start, Joe?
Season one.
You were on season one.
Me and Josh both started, you know, from the beginning and did the whole run, you know.
And that was of Wayne Ewing. We haven't talked about Wayne because I didn't work on the first season. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that later, the difference between his style and John's, or, you know.
Sure. Yeah, because Wayne and Barry Wayne was doing a behind the scenes for some film that Barry was doing. And Barry really liked Wayne's style of work, you know, behind the scenes, just sort of natural cinema verite. And I think that was the genesis of the seed was planted for the concept of Homicide, which was just an ensemble of actors let loose with a script and just a camera amongst them. And with that, Wayne was the camera. That was sort of the pure form of Homicide, which kind of worked, kind of didn't. It was, you know, again, I'm getting ahead of ourselves here, but, you know, conceptually it was something that never really been tried before, and something that didn't really work in terms of actually having actors and script and wardrobe and lighting and everything, and that be completely cinema verite, completely natural. It was sort of a tough thing, and over the years we sort of broke it down and kept some of that initial feeling, but we got a little bit more like whatever normal, or a little more, you know, standard in terms of the way we shot stuff.
Cool. So Josh, why don't you give us your background before the Kingmaker got to you and switched you over to being a gaffer? Where'd you start?
Yeah, I started out as a production assistant doing location work in Washington after high school, 1978, I think was the year. And I enjoyed PAing a lot, but I looked at all the different departments, and I liked the camera guys were a little too pretentious. The sound guys were sound guys. And then the grip electrics were obviously the cool guys. They were like, they really, the nuts and bolts and the hands-on departments. And so I naturally gravitated towards them. And then I was introduced to Murdoch Campbell, who was a gaffer in Washington, D.C., who sort of started the D.C. film community. And I was on a job trying to figure out what to do and where I fit in. And this director famously asked him, what do I do? And he said, well, that's Murdoch. He's really good. Do what he does. And I pretty much have been doing that my whole career. I picked and I was selective about exactly how to follow, what I followed him for. So certain things I left behind, but certain things were good. But anyway, and then Murdoch had started the Washington Source when Joe Kurtz was working in the Washington Source. I was never really staffed there, but I worked out of there a lot, and that's where I met Joe. And then Murdoch was the way I got on the John Waters movies. Murdoch was connected with Dave Inslee, who was connected to the Baltimore scene. Right, Murdoch got tapped to be the gaffer on Hairspray and asked me to be, I think, Best Boy Electric on Hairspray. So that's sort of how I started the whole John Waters, my whole John Waters experience. I ended up being the gaffer on, was it Cecil B. Demented, which was an interesting Waters film. But I started out as Best Boy Electric, and I think Best Boy, I think it was a grip on one of the shows.
Yeah, well, you guys were both on Serial Mom too, right?
Serial Mom. Yeah. And anyway, so that's where I got my start. I started working with Murdoch and was basically the old school, like apprenticeship, much like Joe, where we basically discovered this industry, just started doing it by and learned by, you know, experience and just by apprenticing ourselves to other people. And when I got tapped by John Pacey, who was, I worked a commercial with Wayne Ewing and John in Baltimore, maybe a year before Homicide came online. And Wayne and John were friends. And so Wayne asked John to gaff it since it was used local. And they were talking about who uses key grip. And my name came up. And I was at that time pretty affable and pleasant. So they asked me to come on board and do it. And which was kind of a big leap for me, because obviously I had no idea what I was getting into, which is probably good because I wasn't nervous or anything. But it ended up being, you know, 7-year run of a national television show for a couple of kids from Baltimore to suddenly be thrust into the, into something that big. It was pretty amazing, really, that they didn't bring the keys in from out of town. They trusted us to run the thing.
That's great. I forgot. Yeah. John Pacey, who was also, I worked with him. So he must've also been on the second season.
Yeah. He did like the pilot in the first, what was it, 94? It's all kind of fuzzy, but he did the pilot in the first couple of episodes and then he stepped back, and then we had Stu Stack came in.
Right.
For a while, and then he stepped back, and then I was anointed by the Kingmaker, as Jim Finnerty famously said to me in his slight Brooklyn accent. He said, "Hey, you want to be the gaffer?" And I'm like, "Let's see, same money, twice the stress? No, thank you." He goes, "Let me tell you, kid, either you gaff it, I'll bring you someone down from New York, and he's gonna make your fucking life absolutely miserable." And I'm like, "So, Jim, you make me an offer I can't refuse." He's like, "Because you got it, pal, you make the call." And I'm like, "Okay, I'll gaff it." But Jim has a special place in his heart of hatred for gaffers. And I said, "I'll do it. But you have to promise you're not going to hate me." He said, "I can't promise that." And I was like, fine. So suddenly it became my reign of terror for a couple, you know, the last 5 seasons or whatever it was, where I got to gaff it. But it was, I watched how all the other guys had worked and what they had done and how they try to do things and how what worked and what didn't work. You know, when from the key grip seat, you get to observe a lot, you know, because we're basically, we are running the set, but we're not really, there's a lot of electrical shenanigans that goes on and we just watch and see what works, doesn't work. And so when I was tapped to do it, we kind of revamped the Homicide squad room, but before it was very underlit, very like moody and whatever. And we ended up putting in big coupe lights and bringing the f-stop, the amount of light in the room up, so you could basically go in. If you were in a hurry, you could use it as a cover set, go and just kick the lights on. You could basically shoot. And then if we had time, we'd make nice. We'd add edges sometimes, eye lights, whatever. So we stepped the game up a little bit, made it a little bit nicer.
And we could go back to playing cards.
And I was successful, I guess. But when I stepped up to be the gaffer, Joe Kurtz had been my Best Boy grip.
Yeah.
He stepped up to be key grip, which was great because he was on my side most of the time. And he was great, knew the scene, knew the system. And none of us, there was no anxiety. No, like I had anxiety going in just because the first season I was gaffer, it was either sink or swim with Jim Finnerty and other people nipping at my heels. But fortunately, the choices that we made, the Joe and I together, in terms of, you know, stepping up the game in the stage and having more equipment and being a little more efficient and running the crew better, all paid off. It worked well. And we ended up finishing out the last, what was it, 5 years of that thing?
Yeah. We survived.
Yeah. And you guys were really, really, I mean, my recollection is it really, both your crews really, really worked as a team. I mean, you could sometimes like not figure out like who are the electricians and who are the grips, because you guys were, you had to do so much together because we were moving so fast. And, you might be holding a B board and, you know, somebody else comes in with a Keno, or, you know, I mean, it was just like, this constant motion. And then, of course, Joe, you guys are always building, you know, you're slamming together speed rail, you know, you're getting the butt dolly out. So it was just, how many guys did you each have? How many guys that were on your cruise?
We were pretty, you know, we were limited, you know, to a strict, you know, manpower regime, or it'd be, I don't know, probably like five guys total, right? Each.
Was it three and three, or was it four and four? I can't remember.
It might have been us plus, you know, yeah, a couple. So
it was four, key best boy plus two, I think.
Yeah, that's tiny by today's standards, you know, where right. Like any kind of major television show would have, you know, they're going to have 10 guys, you know, on the first unit.
Yeah, we did a famous crossover with Law and Order, and the director from Law and Order came down. Was it, I can't remember his name.
Did Dick Wolf direct, or was he just there? Was he just there as the producer?
Might have been Dick Wolf.
One of the big guys, yeah.
Was it Dick Wolf?
I remember he came, but I'm not sure if he was directing.
I think he was directing. We did a scene, you know, our crew, our guys went up there. There was their talent came to Baltimore, and we did, you know, a bunch of work with them. And then we had a night exterior at the train station in Baltimore. And we did our usual homicide night exterior, which was a 30-foot G lift ratchet strapped into the back of a pickup truck with a couple of mole bars on the top of it. And me chasing the talent around with a 4-foot Kino tube on a stick, and you know, little lights hidden here and there, and like no real pre-rig crew and no real big setup. And we did this whole scene of them getting out of the detectives getting out of their cars, walking up into the train station, walking through the train station, down onto the tracks, talking, and then getting on the train to go to New York. And we wrapped, we're done, and we're all packing up. And Dick Wolf walked up and just started staring at me. I go, "Can I help you?" He goes, he goes, "We'll talk, you know, tomorrow, like after dailies." And I'm like, "What's he talking about?" Whatever. Oh. And he came to me, not to like, you know, I mean, I don't mean to self-aggrandize, but he came to me and said, "You know, I really thought you used the kind of a vulgar term, rhymes with luck." He goes, "I really thought you'd like screwed me, because where was the equipment? Where was the crew? Where was, you know, in New York, we would have like 18 Ks up on roofs. We'd have big lifts. We'd have all these people, all the stuff." He goes, "You guys had nothing." And I see in dailies, everyone's lit. Everyone has a little edge. It looked great. He goes, "How the fuck you Baltimore guys do this? This is not how we do it in New York." And I'm like, "Hey, welcome to our little weird world. We pull this stuff off." He was shaking his head. He's like, he goes, I don't get it. Because the New York system came up through years of like Kojak and huge shows, sure. And it never really downsized. It was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Right. It's how they always did it. And we came down, our show was supposed to be totally like dot style, like no crew. Like when Wayne and I first sat down with John Pacey and talked, Wayne's concept was that we would be so small, like just one little small cube van would pull in, like the neighborhood wouldn't even know we were there. And the cops would get out of the detectives, actors would get out of their cars, the camera guy would get out of the van, and we'd do the scene. And then we would cut into nobody. It would just be completely like natural. And so the idea was we had little teeny trucks. I think we had two like little small 3-ton cubes with like 12-foot boxes, which is very unusual. Shows usually have multiple 5-tons and 10-ton trucks. Anyway, so I remember Joe and I, in our first little grip truck, we had cut all the pipe and speed rail down to like 12-foot sections. So it actually fit in the truck, which was kind of crazy. Yeah. But we did it because it was Wayne's idea, and
we didn't know any better either. So,
day one, we rolled to the first location. I think it was at a Greenwood Cemetery, Greenlawn Cemetery in Baltimore. And as we're driving in, there's 2-3 blocks of tractor trailers, star wagons, honey wagons, wardrobe trucks. I mean, this like a major motion picture movie. And there we are, this little teeny box truck. And I go, "What happened to?" What happened to the whole concept? It's like, apparently we were the only ones that got the message. The rest of them were like, you know, you need a star trailer. Wardrobe needs to have all the clothes. Camera department needs to have a big, you know, 5-ton truck. But we, you know, Rip Electric, we have these two little teeny vans that we were, you know, it was funny. So subsequent years, that went away. We got the bigger vehicles, which made more sense.
So Joe, jump in here, you know, with how the kind of package maybe you started with and how flexible everything had to be, because you were always in motion.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of, well, for one thing, I don't know, this is kind of the first big deal for me. So it was,
yeah, you
know, the whole, you were placed inside this framework where you only had this many guys and you couldn't pre-light. A lot of times we didn't even scout, or if we did, it was, very minimalist. So we kind of knew you were going to show up there and do whatever you could. And, you know, an hour or so before the UPM came and started glaring at you or worse. So you just try not to be the last department ready to shoot. You know, that was the name of the game. And the you know, AD department breathing down your neck the whole time. So we just kept it limited.
Did you construct the butt dolly? Was that something that you know, key grips have in their back pocket? Or is that something that was developed for the show where you had basically the skateboard wheels on either the Apple box or what was the skateboard wheels on?
I don't know. That was kind of Josh's invention in the whatever first season. And, you know, it was on rails and boxes and, you know, it was kind of making a little roller coaster, like, you know, every day. I wish I had some pictures of it anymore.
It started out in the back of the Cavaliers, right, Joe?
Yeah, we started, doing that, just to make it easier for the DP to, like, move back and forth and side to side to deal, you know.
Because the concept of the show was the camera was one of the actors or like the person watching the show is present in the show. So when we talked about putting the camera on a hostess tray, you know, outside the car looking in, like 99% of every show in the world's done, Wayne was like, well, why would there be someone riding out the street outside the car? It's got to be in the car with the guys. So we have John in the back seat with his the Aton, and he was, you know, trying to like photograph the guy driving and then the reaction of the other guy. So he kept trying to lean over and slide his butt on the seat and really wasn't working. He goes, I need a way to get back and forth. So we got a piece of plywood and polyurethane it. And I recall we went out and got him some silk boxers, which we made him put on, which he was none too happy about. But the silk boxers made him, he could slide back and forth. So that was pretty good. And then Danny Baldwin was observing all this foolishness. And he said he'd worked on a low budget movie where they had got a racing shell. You know, there's a racing shell, a seat that's on rails. And he said they put the DP on those rails and went back and forth. And that gave him the ability. And we thought that was a great idea, but we didn't really have access to any fancy racing shells. But we did have these roller skate wheels that people would put on a big piece of plywood to make sled dollies. And we came up with the idea. It was Joe and I both came up with this 12 by 12 piece of plywood, four sets of skateboard wheels on the bottom of it, and then two rails in the back of the car. We pulled the seat out, put them on these rails, and then he could sit on, he could roll back and forth. And it was great. He could really, you know, slide back and forth and do the driver and then swing over and get the, and then John said, you know, hey, this is great. Can we use this in the squat room? Because the hard thing is when people are sitting down trying to hand hold, but you know, eye height low, is like, unless you're cradling the camera, it's like it kills your back. And we were like, well, yeah, of course. So we got a bunch of different speed rail pipe and we put the pipe on the floor, the box on the 12 inch piece of plywood, and he would sit on it and just push himself along back and forth. And it was, I was hoping for a slightly more, you know, nicer name, but it became the butt dolly. Right. And it's become a industry standard. And I guess Joe and I can take credit for inventing it, I guess, as many things get invented, no one gets credit for it. But I think we worked that. But I was reading some interview with some other director of some show who was saying, oh, this, that, and the other. And he goes, and if we're going handheld, we'll just throw in our butt dolly and just keep going. And I was like, there it is, the butt dolly. It lives. Yeah. That was an example of trying to, like, this interesting, different style of shooting and then having to come up with solutions that were like the whole, like most shows, you go in and there's like two people sitting at a table and you'll sit and light it from wherever, do the two people sitting and you'll do overs and then you cut and then do reset, do overs and overs. In our show, the camera would go everywhere. We'd go 360, which was difficult to maintain interesting back. Like everyone likes light from behind or edgy and nice ratios. But if you're seeing 360, it becomes really complicated. Yeah. So how do we go into a house and get lights into places where we can't have stands? You know, we're clipping lights to like
to the ceiling.
Pipes for radiators. We're putting make-believe pipes for radiators. We're booming things in. It was every day was a challenge, you know.
How long did you have to sort of light situations? Because I think when I spoke to Jean a while back, he was saying there was kind of like a rule of like everything needs to be lit about 25 minutes or something. I mean, how's that work?
He would ask me how long, and I would say 15 minutes, about three or four times.
Oh, that's a good trick. I've used that.
If the one time I said 45 minutes, a PA ran up to me with the radio and said, Jim wants to talk to you. This is Jim Finnerty, the Kingmaker. And I go, hey, Jim. He goes, you ready to get in your car? I'm like, he goes, get a move on. I'm like, yes, sir. So I learned, always say 15 and no one gets 12 because everyone knows that, whatever. Sounds so much better.
Yeah. Unofficial 45. Yeah.
No one wants to get 45. But the other thing I realized was if lighting and grip had been rating 15, there's wardrobe, there's props, there's sound, there's all these other departments that they're not rating 15 either. We're just the highest profile. We're the ones sweating it out in front of everyone doing our thing. Most of the stuff is sort of in the periphery and everyone kind of relies on us taking time to get things ready. So they also have time to prep their departments, which somewhat kind of works.
Yeah.
And we really, by and large, we really made our days. I mean, we did our 99% of the time, we did 12-hour days. We did really.
And the grip equipment you made for the show, this wasn't stuff you had to make like on the day. I'm assuming it's all pre-made. Was it after experience of doing episodes and things?
Yeah, exactly. It was evolving there, Yeah, it was ever evolving. Started out like that and then slowly it did turn into we did some long we would make tracks through the squad room and the stage, and we had curved pipes bent, and we made a 360 track, and it just turned into its own became its own little entity. So quite a challenge just lugging all that stuff around.
Yeah.
But it was a big part of the show. Figuring out how to get the camera moving with no dolly, which was prohibited.
Mm. Yeah. There was never a dolly, was there on the set ever?
The camera was handheld the entire time. The only time it was on sticks was when they shot inserts of the big board or some right in the board. Mm. Otherwise, it was always on someone's shoulder. It was always moving.
Right. Or beauty shots if somebody went out and did B-roll. Yeah.
Yeah. It was great to the actors because it freed them from things like marks and hitting specific marks and being aware of where the camera was and opening up it, because the camera would just be on them. Or sometimes it'd be on them while they were talking. One time I saw John go off the actor who was talking, and I'm like, how come he panned off, Belzer when he's talking? He's like, because a lot of times it's more interesting to see the reaction of the person listening than it is to see Belzer's mouth moving. And I'm like, okay. And John was really a genius. He came from a dot background. He was really intuitive and really good at composition. And just, the Aton, you could sort of look, like most cameras, Airflex SR, it has a big piece of steel here, TK, but the Aton comes down. So with his non-shooting eye, he could look and see what was going on around him. So we'd always be aware of what was worth grabbing, where to swing over. He would just suddenly, and the ACs had their job handy, their job was kind of tough because the focus was constantly, who do you want to be in focus? They had this little sign language of 1, 2, 3, trying to figure out where to throw the focus. It really became kind of a dance after a while between the camera, the guy pulling focus, the Lorenzo or whoever on the boom. Mm. If it was a night scene, I usually had this light on a pole that I would try to hang in to try to key or some of the actors, or use it as an edge for someone else, and just float it around to try to get stuff in. Because if you lit the whole scene overall, which would make it easier, it would just be kind of flat and interesting. So we always tried to have the lights, if at all possible, mobile, so we could move around with the actors and try to keep things interesting looking.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I was thinking when John was talking about you having the Chinese lantern on a fishpole when we were doing night exteriors, and I remembered Lorenzo and any of the boom operators just trying like hell to keep up with everything and stay out of the shot. And then I thought, geez, yeah. And then we had, and then we had Josh with a boom pole with a light on the end of it, in addition to the sound, the boom operator with a mic. So, yeah, crazy.
Yeah, Lorenzo and I, we called it jousting because I had to see where he was. I just sneak in under him. Sometimes our poles would cross and he needed to swing over to catch someone dialogue. And I'd have to duck. I mean, it was really, there wasn't any music, but it definitely was dance.
Definitely.
Oh, I like it. Were there any techniques used to kind of keep up with the choreography of the actors and their performance with the camera moves at all? Were there any kind of particular things that you guys had to do? I
mean, kind of like what Josh said, you know, you had to be, had to have stuff fluid on the fly, you know, figure out how.
Like you'd watch a rehearsal and get a sort of an idea for where people were going to be and like who would go to the window, who would be here and who would be there. And like, you know, some actors are need a little more help with lights than others. So if we saw that going on, we would, while they went off to makeup or get ready, while we had our three or four 15-minute increment sections, we would light what we could. But then invariably when they came back in, they would react differently to each other for whatever reason, the camera differently, and their blocking would change. They'd be in different places. So it had, I would always have to be glued to the monitor, try to see what was going on. And then between, we would cut while we're resetting, like relighting the film or whatever, you know, Joe or myself would run in and tweak stuff to try to change it to optimize. And like the other issue, big issue, was boom shadows, because, you know, not only lighting for the actors, you're lighting for the sound department as well, because even though it's highly irritating, you figure, you know, it's not my fault he's throwing a boom shadow. It is, because I'm putting a light up and I have to be, if I do put a light up, it has, Joe's got to cut it off the back wall, off the wall or wherever a shadow may come from. So, you know, if you're, when you're swinging a big boom pull around, there's just unlimited amounts of shadows that can be cast for every light that you set. So it's every light we put up, you had to also think, how's this going to affect the other department, you know? So it's got
to. Yeah, yeah. Was there a lot of top lighting? Because when I think of Hummus, I don't really think of it as a top lit show. But was that the way you kind of came around it? Or,
well, if it had been up to me, it would have been completely top light. Like a lot of the old New York shows with these coupe lights, these six coupes, these huge 1,000-watt incandescent bulbs. They don't use them anymore. I'm sure it's all LED now. But and if you could light it from the top, super soft or from the top, and super bright, so you have a lot of depth of field and everything. You can basically just shoot, but then it looks like Barney Miller or Kojak, those other shows. It really kind of looks flat and an ears thing. But again, it's really quick and it's forgiving and it works. But all the DPs, the two we worked with, especially Alex Zepchevsky, our second DP, they wanted things edgier and darker and more interesting. I used to joke that the more syllables a DP had in his last name was the higher ratios that he liked his lighting. Zepchevsky, there was definitely three-stop ratio between key side, fill side. Or he didn't even like to key people from the front. He liked to key from behind, leave the face in almost total darkness, and then and key sort of back and make it edgy, which is a lot of, if you look at films, a lot of the really, really pretty films, they're, no one is in a key light that's at the exposure of the camera set. Usually the face is down 2-3 stops, and they're lit from behind or from a bounce off something. It's just, but that style of lighting just takes more discipline. It takes more time and more normal camera stuff. So because like when you have an edge light and you come around behind, that edge light becomes front light. So it was sort of like that was something we worked into the later episodes with Alex. He really wanted lots of hot backlight and edges. So we worked out a plan where he would try to stay on one side and not come around, not do 360s. Because I mean, is a 360 really worth it? Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But if you stay on one side and then do some coverage on the other side, we get a chance to turn these lights off, turn these lights on. Then you can maintain that sort of cool back edgy kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which opened up another can of worms, because Alex was not terribly tall. So, and some of our actors were like over 6 feet. So he ended up looking up at them a little bit, and you're looking up on the set that has, you know, real ceilings, you see the lights. So it was, I wouldn't say headache, because it was a constant challenge to sort of get the lights up out of the way, get them edgy, you know, whatever. We ended up building this camera on their shoulder up about 6-8 inches, and even giving them a extended eyepiece, so we got the camera up, you know, a little higher, which helped.
So no one made him platform shoes. Does that fall into the grip department? Doesn't it? Isn't that not what you're supposed to do?
That's a great idea. Why didn't we think of that? Yeah. That's the story of my life.
Yeah, right.
I have a picture from American Cinematographer that sort of shows, like the combination. Obviously, this is a static shot in the box, but it shows the coupe light above. And then you guys with your little handheld, you and Brian Nollet with the little, like, you know, 12x12 bounce boards, and then a little, is it a soft light or a Kino behind?
Yeah.
So
what a great picture.
That's a great shot of like a combination of all the stuff. Cause obviously on the moving shots, you'd have those little bounce boards running around too. Like, and you said like, as well as the Kino on the boom pole.
Yeah. That brings back memories.
How did you not make noise doing all that too? Because sound people hate anybody doing anything. I mean, like, what was going especially on? Maybe we need to get...
especially our sound guy.
We wore cotton trousers exclusively. Yeah. No synthetics and sneakers, and we were just careful. Like, in the squad room was carpeted, so it wasn't too hard.
But there were many mishaps of people tripping over each other. I mean, that was a daily occurrence of just trying to get out of each other's way.
Well, it was, and also, I mean, the whole concept, especially the squad room, we really could see 360 because we were top soft lit, and generally we're able to shoot in there without any additional lighting at all, except a little bounce guard or something for the eyes. The camera could do anything at any time. So basically, when we were rolling, everyone had to hide. Everyone had to be on the other side of the wall looking at a monitor. No one could really be on set. And the same thing day exterior, which was wonderful because we never really lit the day exterior ever, I don't think, except for like a 4x4 piece of beadboard or maybe a traveling 6x ultra bounce or something. It was basically very sort of a gimme in terms of that, which was good because it gave us time to go and pre-lights the next set so that we would have, as we move from the day exterior in downtown Baltimore to the day night interior bar, we'd have the bar pre-lit or whatever. But again, those in terms of like where do we park the crew vehicles, we see 360. That was just the rule. Like, we'd see anywhere, anytime. So it was complicated. Where do you put Video Village? Where does the director think?
Gotcha.
The director would have a floating little monitor, battery-powered, I think they had a transmitter. Yeah, that. Did we have transmitters back then? Or was it?
Yes, transmitters. Yeah. Yes. Early. Yes. Yep.
So the director would just be behind camera, you know, trying to stay behind them to stay out of the shot.
Oh, we had transmitters.
It was the early days.
Yep.
Yeah, I guess you did.
Yeah,
I
mean, Alex was back there, I won't say, asleep at Video Village. So, Joe, jump in there. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, I was in charge of pre-lighting the bar sets with the grip crew. That was our specialty. While Josh was holding the beadboard, we would go ahead and pre-light the waterfront for 6 hours. And then I would have to try to find all the grips afterwards. But anyways.
So.
Yeah, they all get the bar.
So question about that, because I've been rewatching all the episodes and the squad room especially is really beautiful, colorful. And Chris and I were talking about this earlier, and with Jean, where the background would sort of drop off. Did you use like higher intensity lights in the practicals that were on the desks? What, because it didn't look like Chris just said, it didn't look like a top lit show. Obviously, the night interiors or even the day interiors, you had practicals you could use, but it had a color and a depth that belies the fact that a lot of it was lit from above. So what were you doing?
Well, part of it was Vince Peranio, as we made the top lights brighter. We initially put 6 bulbs in each coupe light and we turned it on, and it was so bright it was scary. It's like, I think at 200 ASA we were like rocking it like a 5-6-8 or something, which was crazy. So we turned them off. I think we ended up with like maybe 3 bulbs in each coupe. So we brought the top light down, and then because the coupe lights tend to light the walls up, Vince was nice enough. He had already made the walls kind of a darker color, but he aged the walls down. He sprayed them down, so the walls made the walls darker with paint. And this way the squadron was laid out, there were so many like nooks and crannies and angles and stuff. It sort of lent itself to looking nice. And then we had those big windows that opened up on the Thames Street that we would, when it was daytime, the windows would be up, and we had 10Ks right above the windows shooting some nice hard light pushing into the squadron. Especially, and we had, very narrow spot Mulpars snuck in different corners and places, just throwing hot splashes of light, so that, you know, the actors in the foreground doing their thing. And then extras walking by, and as an extra walked past where these windows were, they just had a screaming hot edge from a Mulpar, which was just, you know, 8 amps and, you know, a lot of bang for your buck, and expensive and reliable, and literally had a real sunny kind of feel to it, you know, that made a difference.
Yeah, being in a real building helped a lot too, you know. It was just, that was a, wasn't a studio really, it was kind of a, it was a real space that we kind of retrofitted to. Had all the, you know, history built in a little bit.
It was the set design was, you know, often people say, how do you make it look so nice? It's like, it's really come, set design is huge because the way it's dressed and the way it's laid out is, if you have something nice to bounce light off of it, you know, whatever, a white wall is a white wall, but you start getting the colors and all the desks filled with all that stuff. And I don't think we changed any of the, we may use slightly brighter bulbs in some of the desk lamps that we could get a hold of, but I don't think we really did anything crazy bright. It was mostly, and then Alex's other concept, the final of the last two seasons, we put in fluorescent lights, which you can see in the shots in some of the later episodes, because he wanted to have this feel of like, whatever, disappearing lines or whatever. So that was another layer up there, which made it, like, I thought it looked really good too. I like the fluorescent look. It looked very like authentic, which is good.
Yeah. Did they change the paint color of the squad room in season 6 and 7? I vaguely remember something like that.
It figured into the episode that they had redesigned or repainted. Yeah. I don't know if that was in 5, between 5 and 6, somewhere in there.
Yeah. So there's a thing in the movie about cerulean blue. who was it? It's Pemberton's talking about the paint.
Well, I mean, one of the really coolest things, the biggest takeaways for me about work, again, being a kid from D.C. Baltimore, suddenly thrust into working the show, is working with all these talented technical people, and also the actors were all wonderful and just amazing, putting up with us in our quirky, Baltimore ways as they were used to other. And then the other thing was the revolving cast of directors who came in. I think we had 56 or 57 different directors. And it's like it's a who's who. It's like Ken Fink, Alan Taylor, Nick Gomez, Barry Levinson, John McNaughton, Leslie and Larry Lieberman, Barbara Koppel, Catherine Bigelow, Bruno Kirby, Steve Buscemi, all these like A-list, really fucking great, awesome directors that came into our little world. Yeah. And we got to spend a couple of nights scouting with them, getting to know them, and then spent 5 days working really close to them. And it was really just mind-blowing just to hang out and be exposed to how, to see what they brought to the family, see what they sort of brought. With that show like that that's running for, 7 seasons, the directors, it's what they bring to the game is a little subtle because the actors know what they're doing. It's not that you're going to get them to, be different or anything. So they just have little nuances they bring to it. And these great directors were able to come in and know what's going on and sort of push things in a little different direction and put their impart their sort of vibe on it or their feel. That was just really fun to watch.
Yeah, and it occurs to me too, the secondary actors who weren't anybody or much of anybody at the time, like Isaiah Washington was in one episode, and Chris Rock was in an episode. I don't know if we were in the box or somewhere else, and he looked up at me and he said, "What are you doing here working on a thing in Baltimore?" And he was just really funny. And we were talking about Bop Gun earlier, and Jake Gyllenhaal, who played the kid who was like 12. Which I didn't realize when I went back and looked at it. I was like, "What do you mean Jake Gyllenhaal's in this?" And I realized he's one of the kids in that episode.
We did a show with Lily Tomlin.
Yes, right.
Yeah. I mean, all these great. I mean, and spending all this quality time with Ned Beatty. Well, I mean, it was magical. I mean, the most down to earth, most natural, normal guy on the whole planet who just happens to be an actor. He was just great to be with. He was interesting the whole time.
Yeah, so Clark was great.
Clark Johnson, obviously, Andre, Alyssa, Leo. I mean, it was really an opportunity. I mean, I didn't realize at the time. They say, one of the rules in the grip department is don't peak too early. But I think Homicide I definitely peaked on that show. I've had a great career since doing small commercials and everything, but that really was, 94 to 2000, wherever it was, really was the peak of my career. At age 30, I started the show single and living in an apartment in D.C. in Baltimore. And I finished the show married with one child in a house in Bethesda. And it was that was like the apex of my career. It really was. And I mean, it's not that after that, it's all been terrible. In fact, it's all gotten a lot easier, but it really was. We all were really kind of peaking at the time. And I wasn't. I mean, didn't really even realize it. It just seemed it was just a job.
Not me, Josh. I have yet to peak.
You have yet to peak?
I have not peaked yet.
That's interesting that you say that.
Yeah.
Because Joe, do you feel that way too? That it was one of the highlights of your career?
Yeah, it was a great it was a great experience. Didn't know it really at the time how special it was. After that, you thought every job was going to be like that, and they weren't. It was it was a great experience. Everybody kind of lived in the neighborhood, you know, all the actors and, you know, producers and writers and, you know, so much crew was local. You just don't have that anymore where like everybody is from the town, you know, everybody, you know, experienced it in the same way.
Yeah. Jean mentioned that how much of us were all from there. We were all from Baltimore. Yeah. We were all close by. Yeah. We weren't, you know, commuting in for an hour and a half. And he said too that it was the best experience of his career. And in emailing people back and forth also, Frank Farrow, who I contacted, who was assistant director, Chris, also said the best experience of his career. It just was one of those watershed moments where everybody that came to it sort of came to it with a certain kind of energy, I think. And then the show was, it fed on that. Like, we were all having a good time, but the show, you know, sort of inspired that in its creativity and its fast pace and its edginess, I think, just really, you know, it fed on each other, sort of.
Yeah. It was well run and, you know.
Yeah, the experimental nature of it was even reverse, it was groundbreaking. It really kind of was. It was one of the first, I think, shows to be like all handheld 16 and just very like breaking a lot of like the normal rules, the fourth wall stuff kind of. And, you know, it really was kind of a.
And, you know, just the fact that they kept like the working days like at 12 hours, you know, pretty strict, you know. Handful of times we went over 12 hours, you know, and which seemed like a lot back then, but by today's standards, you know, it's that's like the minimum now. And, you know, it's not uncommon for people to have 15 or, you know, 18 hour working days now in this business, you know.
Yeah, a lot of shows are doing 14, 16 hours. Like,
oh God.
All night Friday. Now, our night shoots would be, you know, from dusk for about 2-3 hours, and we'd be done. It was never a massively complicated. I think one of the only times we went long was with Catherine Bigelow. She's Academy Award winning
Hurt Locker
for the show about Foot Locker, Hurt Locker. Yeah, we had a big shootout scene in the squad room, and we all expected we call time at 7 a.m. At 7 p.m. I was thinking I'd be headed home, and I think we ended up going to like 10 or 11 o'clock that night, because when you're working with Squibs and the company like again and again and again, that went long. That was highly unusual, but it was, you know, for a reason. And our Jim Finnerty, who never let anyone go over 12, understood that. He had actually budgeted for it. And he was like, it's fine. Yeah, we got to get this. Let's just do it. It was so good. That was one thing that a lot of the directors had to realize, is that in pre-production, they were told, you have 12 hours at 7, and, you know, 12 hours after call time, we're wrapped because we need the crew. It's not a money thing so much as that we're doing 9 months of this show and we can't burn out the crew. Everyone has to get sleep. Everyone has to get off, you know, whatever. And the directors would, you know, start the day out kind of like, not languidly, but sort of chill and, you know, plodding along. And then the last 4 hours, they'd be like in a dead run to get what they had to get. And they would always try to push it a little bit. But at the 12-hour mark, if they weren't wrapping up, they're literally just...
Here comes the Lincoln,
Jimmy,
right?
Would show up in this blue Lincoln driven by Ford Wilgus, our awesome teamster captain, who was, was the guy that Danny DeVito did Tin Man. He spent a week with Ford Wilgus to vibe him out. And that's how he based his character on Tin Man. Was it Tin Man?
Really?
Anyway, Danny DeVito used Ford Wilgus as his muse. That's who Ford was. Anyway, Ford would drive Jimmy to set, and we'd be all sitting there, and I'm like, any minute now, that blue Lincoln's going to turn the corner. And sure enough, his blue Lincoln turned the corner, come to a stop, and Jimmy would get up and be like, tick-tock, tick-tock. The only thing's moving is the clock. Come on, let's get out. Have a conscience. We're done. And the director would be like, I need one more shot. And he'd go, turn off the generator. And the director would be like, what are you doing? No, I need this more shot. And Jimmy goes, hey, I told you 12 hours. I mean, in plain English, you're done. We're done. And the director would be like, you know, going thinking, obviously I'm the director. I have a juice. I could do anything.
I have a conscience.
Like, I get it. You're out. Go. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
It was just the greatest thing. We all just sit back and go, yeah, okay. It was great. So great. Because, you know, ultimately he had our backs, which was crucial.
Yeah.
You know, that was we all felt that we were protected by him in terms of that. You know, we're going to have some director come in and beat us to death. And run super late, the gym was going to be shut it down, which was good.
There's a funny combination between being terrified of him and also appreciating that he would pull the plug for us, you know? True. Go ahead, Chris.
I was going to ask just how many setups you guys had to do, because we heard earlier, I think it was like 7 pages of dialogue a day or something like that, or even more.
Yeah.
That was a slow day.
Yeah. We even heard there was like 16 at one point.
Yeah, I don't think it was, I think average was, I mean, I don't know if this is factual, but I would recall the average of being 10 to 12 pages of dialogue a day. But a lot of that wasn't like big resets and big massive scenes. It was just dialogue, like in the squad room or something. But a lot for the actors to get through and a lot for, you know, but it depended on also on company moves. And the production and the ADs and Jimmy were, they're very savvy in terms of what we could actually physically accomplish in a day. Like if they came in with a script that had a huge net exterior, Jimmy would look at it and go, he would take his pen and would say exterior. You would just scratch it out and write day exterior. and the writer would go, no, it's got to work at night. And Jim goes, the hell it does. He said, there's no way we're shooting on the water at night. Yada, yada, yada. This is a day exterior. And, you know, it wasn't like take it or leave it. It was like take it, you know? And it was like, a firm hand on the tiller, as it were. Really, really kept the boat steered in the right direction. And it was feared. But respected as well. You know, he was very, very tough on people that he felt were not being forthcoming or honest. And he was also supremely loyal to people he felt had his back. He really was. Unless you were the gaffer and all bets were off.
Yeah, if you were working hard and doing a good job, he let you know he appreciated it. Yeah, absolutely.
Good. Were there so just talking sort of more widely, were there any episodes, stories, or sort of incidents during filming that sort of stand out for you?
Can we talk about the great Ned Beatty imbroglio of season 4? No, I don't want to get into too much.
What's the great poupon? Is that what you mean? Throwing the mustard jar?
There was a lot of passion, on the set. Like Nick Gomez and Yaphet Kotto got into it one time. There was, you know, a lot of.
Oh, I don't remember that. I remember Ken Fink wasn't it Ken Fink with Ned Beatty in the bar at Doodah's? And a jar of great poupon flying across the bar. And everybody's like, okay, take 10 minutes, right?
Yeah, we actually all got to home early that day because it was, it's passion, you know? Everyone has this passion for, you know, what is it? Barry Goldwater famously said, extremism and the pursuit of perfection is no vice. Brutally paraphrased Goldwater. It's true. I mean, that's the whole thing about everyone comes in really, you know, wanting to do their best, the directors, the actors, everything. And if the director feels like the actor's not picking up the cup of coffee on the right cue, he'll tell them. But then the actor's a guy who knows what he's doing, who's this punk kid telling me when to pick up my coffee. And then it escalates. And again, it just boils over because everybody, and it's because people care. If no one cared, they just say, I'll pick it up coffee whenever you want me to. I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm just here for the paycheck. Nobody on that show was there. Well, we were all there for the paycheck, but beyond the paycheck, we were also there just to create this crazy, eccentric, different, you know, free-flowing kind of show.
Definitely. No, and it shows. I mean, Joe, I don't know if you have any sort of memories or anything that stand out for you.
It was such a long time ago, but I don't know. The story I always tell was like the very first day of like the very first season. I was like, still, whatever. I'm like a 20 something fresh faced kid or whatever, working in the truck. And Jim Finnerty, who's it's no secret, enjoyed a drink or two in his time as an old school New Yorker. But he comes on the grip truck, and I was already scared of him. And he goes, you got alcohol on this truck? So I was like, I swear, sir, there's no alcohol in this truck. And he gets out. His wallet gives me like $200. He goes, go get something for yourself and get me some vodka while you're out there. You know, I was like, okay, that's how it's gonna be. So kind of.
He popped on the truck one day, and we on the grip truck. We did keep a bottle of Smirnoff, and he hopped on the truck one day, and he goes, "Where's the bottle?" I'm like, "What bottle?" So we all had a celebratory. This is halfway through, like. The day or halfway through a kind of an afternoon night shoot, and we all had a glass of vodka, which I never do at work. I just, it takes my, you know,
yeah,
it takes my edge away with the little edge I have. And I got back on set and John's like, where were you? I go, oh, I was, you know, and he goes, have you been drinking? I'm like, John, I had to. It was kind of like, and he goes, what? I go,
right. Jim Finnerty says it.
It was a different time back then, you know, in the 90s, you know, post 80s. It wasn't uncommon at all to, you know, have whatever.
Yeah.
A two martini lunch and, you know.
Take something to take the edge off.
Yeah, exactly. Here it's gotten a little, you know, legally prohibited, but, you know, it's changed here a lot. But back then it was much more, you know. Or part of the day.
Oh, it still happens definitely in certain areas.
What was I watching? I guess it was Sniper again, watching us hanging cameras off the roofs of a building because we were shooting straight down. Can you talk sometimes about those kinds of things where you're sort of you don't have equipment for like hanging the camera over the side of a building. You know, somebody just like laying on the sticks or dropping, you know, 100 pounds of sandbags on the end of the stick so the camera can literally be, you know, literally off the side of the building.
Yeah, we had to improvise a lot because, you know, I mean, part of it was we were just, I don't know, I was all local. I didn't have a lot of, you know, outside influences about how those things were going to be done. And also, you know, we weren't going to get any extra equipment. They weren't going to give us a crane or anything. So you may do. We did, you know. I remember Josh when, you know, Jean wanted to, we had that huge, like, you know, giant two-story staircase in the stage. And they played a lot of scenes in there. And we would, you know, Jean would walk up backwards, you know, following the actors up the steps and trip and fall down or whatever multiple times. So we made like we got a chair out of the office and tied some poles on it. And we made like a,
yes, like I forgot that. Like
a sedan
chair homemade.
Have four guys.
That's right.
Yeah. Luckily he wasn't one of your, you know, larger DPs. So it was manageable. But yeah,
Is that how you guys did it? Yeah, because those stair scenes are quite smooth. So how did that thing work? So it was on poles. And it was just being pulled down or something.
It was just a chair with like four poles tied onto the legs.
So it was two. It was through the side of the on the wasn't it put through the arms or was it through the legs? Yeah, crossways. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there'd be four guys. Yeah, no steady cam.
Yeah, this is before the day of, there was Steadicam around, which you never used, but before the day of Movies or, you know, Osmo's little small cameras. This was all the same camera, all handheld, no special fancy rigs.
Because they look good, those stair shots, considering it's supposed to be handheld. We asked John this earlier, like with some of the technology around today, if Homicide: The Next Generation was to be made, not with Patrick Stewart, but you know, what kind of technology would you do you think you might use that might be a bit different to what you used back then?
Yeah, I can't imagine what it would look like today.
Well, lighting-wise, it would certainly have been the most cutting-edge lamp we had back then were Kinoflows, which were great, but the output was a bit limited. That and the other huge thing is the speed of the, you know, the ASA of the film we were using. I think we generally ran at 200 ASA, Susan, and then the night stuff was probably 400 or something.
Yeah, and then apparently, according to the International Cinematographer story, switched to something that we used 7279 for interiors and night exteriors. So initially it was 7293 with 400 ASA indoors and 200 outdoors. But I don't know if the different film was more forgiving.
Most cameras these days, their native ASA is starts at 800 and quickly goes up. We were shooting yesterday in Ohio doing interiors and we were cranking at 1600. The new Airy 35, and it looks absolutely beautiful. So, like the concept, it'd almost be easier now to do Homicide with these cameras that have like insane latitude. You know, they have 12 stops, not usable, but 12 stops of latitude, and insanely fast chips because you really don't need the light at all. You almost don't need to control windows. It's phenomenal. We were working with a film stock that if you didn't light it, the darks would just go purpley and gross. There'd be gray. And it was, that was the, and we had these Kinos, which at 200 or 320 ASA, you get maybe a 2.8 out of them on a good day at about 5 feet. You couldn't make them brighter. You couldn't change the color. These days with stereotypes or the brighter LEDs or the new apertures are coming out, you have full control over the crazy brightness, color temperature. Also, dimmer cues are much are seamless now. Everything's controlled off iPads. We had like the old school dimmer board with like an old CRT monitor in a back room, which we never really used because A, we couldn't figure it out. B, it was just too complicated to try to do cues when everything's changing constantly. You can do cues when you know exactly ABC.
I remember that thing. It was huge.
And for that whole 360 stuff, if you had LEDs and you had an iPad right behind the camera, you could be doing sliders. You could then control where the lights, what the lights were doing. We just didn't have the technology, didn't have the bright enough one.
Yeah. Joe, would you do anything differently? Because you were going to say something.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you could make that show again today. You know, I don't know if the, just from what I've seen, people don't know how to work in that kind of, you know, framework anymore. You know, even stuff that's supposed to be kind of when they're, it's just everything's bigger now. There's, you know,
there's no fancy tech that make your life easier or anything.
Oh yeah, I mean they would, yeah, of course they would do everything, you know, whatever steady, they'd have a steady cam and a,
well, he'd already invented all the fancy stuff for the show. You know, we'd use the same, I'm sure he'd still use a butt dolly.
Exactly.
You know, the
pipe dolly. Yeah, motorized butt dolly or something.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah, and I think would it be hard to get the same feel because if the digital cameras are so perfect, you wouldn't have the sort of verite feel anymore with a digital camera that makes everything beautiful, right?
Yeah, that's true. The look would be different. Yeah. And that part of it was the gritty aspect of it. And some, it certainly, I mean, I was flying by the seat of my pants trying to light this stuff. You know, I hadn't done a lot of episodic like TV drama stuff before. So I was really figuring out as I went along and I made some mistakes and a lot of stuff was underexposed. And a lot of stuff was, you know, so some of that lent itself to the final product.
Yeah.
It's great. There's happy errors, I guess. But you wouldn't get that with the modern cameras because they're so incredibly forgiving.
Yeah, indeed.
So. And we were talking too earlier with John about, I mentioned that I think even today, a lot of shows don't do a very good job of lighting actors with different skin tones. And when you go back and look at Homicide with the incredibly diverse cast we had, and not just diverse people, but diverse skin tones, that it looks great. I mean, it doesn't look like, I mean, I watch shows still today where I think that cameraman or that gaffer didn't know how to light dark skin. And you don't see that on this show. And you guys did a great job, even with all that, all those trippable moments where everybody's running around and trying to get out of each other's way while the camera's moving. Yafit still look great and Andre still look great. Really kind of amazing.
If you have Reed Diamond and Yafit Kota next to each other in a bar scene, right. It's definitely 100% a lighting challenge. And it's something that I would look at a call sheet and or the daily call sheet and go, okay, this actor. Okay, today's going to be relatively simple. Today's going to be more complicated. And when we saw who was up, we would definitely spend extra time and make a huge extra effort to try to get, you know, to adequately light people who needed to be lit more. Absolutely. It was definitely a challenge. That's one reason why we developed the 4-foot tube on a stick was to, I would basically hover over Yafit at night exteriors. I would be on his just 3/4 back or even more frontal on him at all times. And when he was off camera, I would take the stick and put it behind like Reed Diamond and just give Reed a little back edge or something or whatever. But it was amazing. If I saw the camera go to Yafit, I was right there with the tube. And you've never really noticed the light shifting or changing. It's just really because the camera's moving, everything's moving, then suddenly he's exposed properly. And that 4-foot tube is so broad that it becomes a nice, soft, wrappy sort of light source. It really did great work. But it was an absolute challenge, and thank you for noticing that. We try our best, and most of the times it worked. There was a couple of moments, one on the ramp that I recall that Jim Yoshiro threatened to murder me, as did Yafit, just because he stopped in a place. It was, we're doing playing the scene under these overhead scoops, and he was well lit at that point, and I just had a little bit of fill light, a battery fill light, and. In a couple of subsequent takes, he didn't stop there. He just stopped in a pool of just darkness, which, you know, for that film stock and under lighting someone like that, didn't play well. And basically, I think they still used it, but there was talk about trying to reshoot it and everything. Infinity was like, absolutely not. It's, you know, move on. We're fine. We're good. And I was horrified. It was the fact that I still remember this, you know, a couple years later.
But back to what you just said about the scene on the ramp, that's the only ones I watched last night was Sniper 1 and 2. There was a scene where Isabella Hoffman, who is white and blonde with Clayton LeBeouf, and they're arguing as they're going up the ramp. And the last shot, Clayton stops in absolute blackness, and it's just his silhouette. But right, like leading him, right in front of him, the other side of the ramp was really brightly lit, and it's cutting back and forth between them. But it was this beautiful shot of him silhouetted in the dark and her, you know, it was a sort of soft, warm light on her. But the tension of the scene and him being the villain in that scene, because he was saying no to everything and then he eventually demotes her. It was perfect. And I don't know if that was an accident or that was on purpose, that particular one.
Well, was that Jean or Alex?
That was, and I can't remember if that was part one or part two, because part one was Jean directing and shooting. And then part two was Darnell, Darnell Martin. So I'm not sure which.
I think it's part one. It's part one. Okay. She gets demoted in part one.
Okay. So that was with Jean then, but it was, great.
Back to what I said earlier about Jean just being such an intuitive camera guy, aside just from frame and composition. I don't know if he directed to be in or out of the light or whatever, or just saw it and just went for it and used it, you know, and didn't put the camera down and say, hey, we need to light this. He just knew intuitively, probably with, you know, as a director and as a director of photography, that worked in terms of the scene, you know, in terms of the script and
everything,
which is great.
And it looked perfectly natural too in that, you know, in that environment.
Yeah, the building just forces you to do that kind of stuff. You know, you can't knock out a cement wall and put a light up or a grid. That ramp was just a concrete tube. You couldn't there's nowhere to hide anything. Mm.
The ramp that was at two or three floors, we had to push our equipment up every day. That was the best exercise you could ever get.
Every day was a leg day.
Two 200 yard.
Good to the cab.
Every day somebody'd say, do you want help with that? When I was pushing the camera cart up, and I'd be like, no, this is the only exercise I'm going to get today is pushing this thing up three floors. Well, I get other exercises.
Elevator.
That was a shoulder builder for sure. Yeah. Have you guys been down there? Since they transformed it into the fancy hotel.
The Pendry, Joe and I had drinks there a year or so ago. Yeah, I went into the ballroom and it is just the old squadron is now.
Me too.
It's beautiful. It's a little much.
It is
for Phil's point. It is amazing. Yeah, big change. It's a transition.
It's gorgeous. I mean, you finally see, we had all our sets built except for the coffee room. You could actually see those, you know, 2-story high. Arched windows, but now, you know, you can actually see the architecture of what the space actually looked like.
Yeah, the building became a character itself. Originally, they were looking at the Hippodrome Theater as a place. They have, when Jim was first scouting Baltimore, and the City Pier was a possibility, and he looked at it just thinking of it as a space to build sets inside. He never thought of it necessarily as being the police station, but it was sort of a happy accident. Beautiful brick,
the permanent
building built, I guess, in the 30s or something, just stately, and it turned into the exterior as well, which was fabulous. It was so great,
right? And really iconic, you know. So you could still see people standing in front of it getting their pictures taken, but not because it's a Pembry, because it was the homicide sets.
Mm-hmm. Well, that'll be me hopefully next year, but
I'll have to get you down there. Get us all down there. You're buying, Chris.
Exactly. Well, here the crabs are good, and is it the chicken livers? Was that
we were talking about the chicken livers this morning. Chris asked Jean, or asked both of us about crabs, and Jean said, no, the best part was the fried chicken livers. And we started talking about you guys when we were in West Baltimore, go to the corner convenience store and come out with a paper bag full of fried gizzards and and livers, and you know, like pass them around to everybody, and how good they were.
That was I blame Joe Kurtz for that completely, but
yeah, I agree.
The great thing about being in Fells Point and being in that building was that Big Eight, we're done, it's a wrap.
Yeah.
We 7 a.m. call tomorrow, whatever. We would just drop our tools and walk out the door, walk directly across the street to John Stevens and sit down and have a couple of beers. And invariably, then the camera department would trickle in, some of the actors would trickle in, John might trickle in, we'd all be buying each other's drinks. And it was such a family, like you'd work hard together all day. And in the evenings, you would decompress and tell stories. And it was just, at least in the first like 3 or 4 seasons, everybody went out at night pretty much all together. It's like we couldn't get enough of each other during the day. We had to go to the bar and and continue the day into the sometime in the early seasons into the wee hours. I remember a few times stumbling back from the bar to my little one room shack of an apartment in Fells Point and falling asleep, having to get up in 5 hours and go back to work. Which was, I only could do that because I was in my, you know, late 20s, early 30s. It would not fly anymore.
Yeah.
But it was
and the migration from, sometimes it was John Stevens and that was the waterfront. And then somehow, I don't know, we got kicked out of the waterfront and then we ended up at Cooper's.
Yeah, Cooper's became the favorite.
Yeah.
A lot of bars to choose from. Both were no shortage of great pubs.
One after the other.
Yeah. Well, I think we're getting a bit close to wrapping up, but are there any other sort of key things you want to talk about before we do part ways today? Any, could be memories, could be anything, and maybe even something, thoughts on the enduring legacy of the show as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely is a great time capsule of like a Baltimore that's kind of fading away. I watch it every now and then just to see the, you know, the locations and whatever. And I'd also like to take 1 second just to say a memoriam to my best boy, who was Dave Wilkins. He did the whole show. Also, he died in 2018.
Yeah, Dave was clutch.
He was a great part of the show.
Great sense of humor. Yes. Great strong character. Yeah,
yeah, he was a terrific guy.
He had a few demons, but he was a smart, funny guy.
That's what makes everyone interesting. So it was the dark side.
Don't we all?
We definitely lost a few people from that show over the years.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly quite a lot of the cast now, sadly. But
And Randy, Randy Lee, Randy Lee before Dave,
Jim Finnerty,
Jim, Ned Beatty,
For
30 years. It's hard to believe.
It is hard to believe.
I was the young guy on set.
But definitely a great experience, and I mean, I don't know what sort of magic fairy dust got spread that I was tapped to join John and Wayne in that very first show. Again, I really had no idea what I was getting into. We walked into that ballroom, and Wayne Lamondola, the local IE grip that Finnerty hired, they're building the grid over the set walls. And he was like, "Oh, you're the key grip. How high do you want the grid?" And I'm like, "I have no clue." And I'm like, like right about here. He goes, "Okay." And I was like, "Jesus." And little did I know that height, we would work at that height for 7 seasons. And it was good because you could reach lights, but you also had to, you would bang your head if you walked around. So it could have been a little bit higher, but what did I know? I was like, you know, zero clue. I mean, I had some, you know, fortunately worked on a couple of big films with the key grip from New York, this guy, Don Cerrone, who brought me along on a couple of shows at the third. I did a Mickey Rourke film in Asbury Park, New Jersey, where I was as a third, just humping sandbags and loading stuff. I was able to just observe how he ran a grip and what he did and what was expected of him. And then when I got tapped to be the key grip, I had some tools in my toolkit to sort of figure out, you know, how to act, how to make this work, how to run the crew, especially, and how to count on me. Much like Jim protected everyone from directors or whatever, my job was kind of run my crew and protect my crew from being, you know, from being late or, you know, being not ready for something. I always had to think, especially on this show, you had to really think well ahead of the next day, the next setup. Where can we pre-stage in this next area so that we're ready to go and we're not like hold the bag? Like, you're supposed to put, you know, build this or do that. Just to have things ready ahead of time. That was, and I learned that from Don and from other people that I've worked with. But I mean, not to say I was completely unprepared for it, but I was pretty much completely unprepared for it. I just had, you basically get into it because it was also different. It was, we all learned together and we all came up together and we all figured it out together. Part of that whole, you know, familia thing, which was so great.
Excellent. Well, Susan, I don't know if you have any sort of final thoughts or anything else you'd like to ask before we wrap up today.
No, I don't think so. I agree with all that. It was a real unique experience, and also just one of those situations where you just look around and go, you know, there isn't a better crew anywhere. And I worked in Hollywood for 8 years with some really good crews, and to come home, you know, and see some of the people I went to college with, all having been in, you know, in the industry for a decade, and to end up on this show with some of them, and like, you know, at the time, the best show on the air. It was absolutely the best show on the air. And to have to be doing it at home after having lived in LA for 8 years was amazing. I mean, it was just crazy good. It was great.
Well done all of you for that. It's you know, can't believe it's, yes, 30 years, isn't it? So well done. It's still being talked about, celebrated, and you know, it's a great show.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris.
So thank you, Josh and Joe, for joining us today. It's been really great chatting with you.
Yeah.
Pleasure. Pleasure's all ours. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So that was Josh and Joe, and that was a very detailed conversation, and I thought it was really interesting, and I particularly appreciated the butt dolly, because the butt dolly was so integral to scenes in the box. And Jean very kindly shared a photo of me ages ago, which is on our Instagram, of a scene in the box where he is on the butt dolly. And it is quite an ingenious little invention, so then Jean could use his feet to kind of go round smoothly the table at eye level. And I was looking it up. So Panavision, who are one of the big rental companies and camera manufacturers in America and Europe, they actually have their own butt dolly now, which is quite funny. And
it looks very fancy.
It's I was looking it up and I thought it's super fancy. And then there's some other rental companies across the UK that have them. And one company has misattributed its invention to the TV show 24. So they claim that TV show 24 invented the butt dolly, when we have found out that no, it wasn't 24, it was Homicide.
And we can set the record straight right now.
Yeah.
Because that was, like they said, it was a piece of plywood, 12 by 12, nice varnished piece of plywood. They put, I think it was eight skateboard or was it eight? One, two, three, four. Yeah, eight skateboard wheels on. And the skateboard wheels were canted. Because of course the speed rail is round, so they were canted so they would hold onto the track.
Yeah.
But yeah, oh, let's spread that around.
Yeah, it just made me laugh a little bit. And then, and you were explaining to me off air the sedan chair, because when they explained it, I still didn't quite fully get it. But the technical challenge to try to overcome was filming shots as people were walking down the stairs.
Or up the stairs. He would walk backwards up the stairs with somebody holding onto his belt and helping pull him up each stair, which is when the sedan chair got invented.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So think about this for a moment, everybody. So a camera operator literally has to either walk backwards, up or down some stairs. Now, I don't recommend you do this at home, but with the power of imagination, you can imagine what it must be like going backwards down the stairs with a very heavy camera on your shoulder. So this sedan chair obviously allowed then Jean or other camera operators to sit in this chair and kind of be carried down. So not only are they getting a nice smooth shot, but it's kind of removing some of the danger and risk involved with going backwards downstairs.
And I think, my recollection, it was an old school metal office chair.
Yeah,
I think a little padding in the back and the seat, but really old school, that was pulled off the set. This was not like, let's get a chair, cut the legs off. It was the chair with the speed rails strapped to it underneath so that they could hold it from both sides.
Yeah.
Two rails underneath the chair and that were strapped to the chair. And then at least it must have just been two guys on each side holding two rails, either walking up or down the stairs, depending on what the shot was. So, yeah. Very, very low tech for a very effective, smooth shot, which, like you, Chris, looked at and said, how did they do that? You know?
Exactly. And I didn't see Panavision have their own one. So obviously nobody else has attempted this since then. Because I think now, am I right, people are actually still walking backwards downstairs, but now with Steadicams and things. It just seems like a really dangerous way to do that.
Well, if you think about it, the Steadicam, even though the Steadicam operator is looking at the monitor, the Steadicam operator does not have the camera in his eye. So Jean was doing it with the camera in his eye and the other eye, you know, looking around and seeing where he was, but could be more easily done, I think. You know, I'm not a Steadicam operator, but more easily done with the Steadicam because the Steadicam operator has his or her eyes, both eyes open and can see their surroundings. Obviously, they have to pay attention, you know, focused on the screen. Yeah. But maybe easier with a Steadicam.
Definitely. And if anybody's not sure what a Steadicam is, it's just a vest that a camera operator wears with a mechanical arm that kind of extends from the vest. So basically then the camera is suspended from the arm. And with the power of, I guess, physics and engineering, it keeps the camera smooth. And it kind of almost creates a kind of boat-like motion. And it means that the camera operator can walk around and you don't get the footsteps of the camera operator. It's just nice and smooth. So it kind of glides. And it became very famous on a film called The Shining, which I believe Stanley Kubrick actually worked with the inventor of the Steadicam on The Shining. Mm. And they would do all those sort of chase sequences through the maze at the hotel. And then some of the shots as well of following the boy on the bicycle, whose name completely escapes me right now. But those very iconic shots from The Shining were all with Steadicam. So usually in the past, you'd have to use something called a dolly to achieve similar kind of shots, where it's a camera on... I suppose it's a bit like train rails is probably the best way to crudely describe how dolly works. And a dolly requires people to then push the camera along these rails. And the downside of that is obviously the rails are very heavy and the whole dolly that the camera goes on is incredibly heavy as well. So it means it's very slow to set up. And on a show like Homicide, you don't have like 2 hours to set up a single shot. So the Steadicam, well, they didn't even use Steadicams on Homicide, but you're all handheld. But on a lot of other shows, they use the Steadicam to kind of get that dolly feel, but without all the setup time of a dolly.
Yeah, also, the dolly track, you know, it's a track, like a train track, and you're limited to that movement up and down, whichever direction you set it, you're limited to that movement in addition to the panning and tilting of the camera and the booming up and down on the dolly arm. But yeah, the Steadicam, the very heavily sprung articulated arm that's so heavily sprung that when you put the camera on it, it allows the camera to float, basically. It's a very, it does take a bit of setup because it has to be perfectly balanced. It throws off the center of gravity of the operator. If you've ever seen a Steadicam operator walking, they walk, their legs are out ahead of them because they have all the weight on their hips from the articulated arm, which is holding the camera out two feet ahead of them. So, floating on a heavily springed articulated arm is really what it's doing. And the really good Steadicam operators is you don't feel the floatiness. You just feel the very steady smoothness, but not the motion, the up and down and back and forth like you're in a ship motion. You shouldn't feel that, you know, unless the director wants it. But so that it's invisible. It's invisible, smooth, but it's invisible. It doesn't call attention to itself.
I will say there are some TV shows that will remain nameless where it does feel like a boat because the directors obviously asked the Steadicam operator to do a lot of things. Where I just remembering a shot from a show I saw recently. So the camera starts, I think it starts on a close-up of a person sat behind a desk. It then kind of does a 180 looking towards the door as two people walk in and the camera walks the people towards the people coming in the door, then tracks back with them and kind of does a reverse of the shot it started with, which is a lot. There's a lot going on there. And there was lots of boat motion. and I'm assuming they only had a few goes at it because of schedules. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing actually just came out with the interview as well. So what's remarkable about Homicide behind the scenes is every day was generally a 12-hour day, whilst in television, that's very rare and getting even rarer, and it shouldn't, because a 12-hour day is very hard work. And it's not just 12 hours, it's then plus your commute getting there and back, plus most crew members always turn up a minimum about 30 minutes earlier than the call time that you're given. So it's a very long day, and it's a very physical day on a film set. And there have been tragedies where people have died because they've fallen asleep driving home. And I think that's one of the still big problems in the film industry today, is these sort of creeping days that going into like 15 plus hours. It's not great. So what was interesting is Jim Finity, the kind of other unsung hero of Homicide, kind of very, very wisely did his very best to keep those days at 12 hours. And I'm fascinated by Jim Finity, and I'm enjoying these various descriptions. I feel like I'm getting to know him a bit now when his name comes up.
He's emerging.
Yeah.
Everyone we have interviewed has mentioned him. Everyone. Yeah. As the dual personality of keeping the show running and protecting the crew, and also everybody at some time or other being completely terrified of him, which is what kept things running smoothly. But the idea, I loved when they talked about, here comes the Lincoln. You know, if we were pushing up against our 12 hours, and somebody on the crew, probably the ADs who are keeping him informed of what's going on, you know, say like, we still got, you know, another half page to do or something. He would emerge from the office, jump in the Lincoln and come down, and you know, and he would do exactly what these guys said. Like, you're done. You're finished. You're done for the day.
And apparently Danny DeVito based his performance on Jim Finity in the movie Tin Men. So I'm going to have to watch. Tin Men now. Thanks to, I was it Josh or Joe said that? I'm going to have to watch Tin Men now just to get a better sense of what Jim Finity was like.
I had never heard that. And I wondered what the circumstance was.
That's a Barry Levinson film, isn't it? Tin Men. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. One of his trilogy. That they spent enough time together before shooting the show, I mean, he's a production manager, so you connect with him at some point, I guess, as the actor. I know we do as the crew. I never really thought about the kind of interaction the actors have with a production manager before production. But he definitely was an iconic personality. As they say, you know, not to make a comparison, but, you know, he kept the trains running, you know. That's what he did. But we did know that he had his back. And there were times when he asked us, you know, one of his other sayings was one hand washes the other. There were times when he asked us, you know, to waive turnaround time because we had a specific issue and, you know, we had to come in earlier than our turnaround time would be. You know, let's say if we had your contract might say you can't come in earlier than 10 hours or 8 hours or 12 hours from your, you know, when you finish the night before, he may ask us to waive that. And I actually only remember that happening once. It might've happened more than once. It struck me on particularly on this interview with Josh and Joe, when he started talking about them, I started remembering everyone we've talked to has mentioned him as a driving force on keeping the show going and together and supporting the crew and the show. So, we may have to do a Jim Finity episode, just have everybody.
I think we do need to. I don't know how that we will do that, but it'd be good to do something about
classic.
Him,
he was an iconic, iconic character, but sorely missed, I'm sure, in the film business because he was so efficient.
Is there anything that stood out for you in the episode, or anything you'd like to mention?
Well, it's interesting. When we recorded it, it was just a conversation, you know, about what we did.
Yeah.
When I listened to it back, it struck me on absolutely, first of all, how deeply technical we got about what they did and what we did on the show.
Yeah.
But also it made me remember that whole, and I know as a camera assistant, which you do, you have to do on every show, but particularly on this show, you have to think on your feet. you can never, and that's another thing when you said how physically demanding a 12-hour day is, it was also incredibly mentally demanding. Because there is no point where you could look away, like literally. when I came into the business, I was trained, you never take your eyes off the camera assistant and the cameraman or camerawoman. I never worked with a woman director of photography. It was always cameraman. So you could never let your guard down and you always had to think on your feet. And everyone on the set had to do that because of how quickly we moved and how quickly things changed. And I think that came across on this discussion. And for them, how quickly they modified, moved, changed things, brought in things, decided, you know, this will work in this situation. You know, how are we going to get a light on Yafit when we're moving around the room? You know, we have a kino on the end of a pole, or do we have a paper Chinese lantern on the end of a pole? And I love the story about Dick Wolf. And we would not, we should probably look it up. We could never remember if Dick Wolf had directed the episode or if he was there, you know, as a producer of the crossover.
Let me have a look.
But when he watched Josh and Joe light the exterior, the night exterior scene, and was incredulous once he saw the dailies about what little they did with what we had and how great it looked. That I think was a real, I think, example or testament of how well what they did work, what we did worked with what we had, and the inventiveness of it, and in some ways the minimalism of it. It in many ways it had to be minimal.
Yeah,
because you couldn't have all these accoutrements and all this, you know, huge production going on around when we're working like a documentary crew where we're moving around so much and so quickly. And then of course, all the locations and all the practical locations, you know, we didn't have sets where you could move the walls around, you could move the ceiling, you could pull the grid up. You know, we didn't have any of that. Maybe you could move the lights up a little bit, but above us. But as far as any kind of traditional working on a set, sets, we didn't have any of that.
No. Dick Wolf was the producer because he's not credited at all as directing. He's just down as a producer.
So he came down to make sure, you know, how the crossovers were going.
Yeah.
And I did like the discovery or the realization that Josh pushed it over to Joe that the entire responsibility for the fried gizzards and livers was Joe. Josh said that was Joe.
Excellent.
So if anybody tries to steal that from us and say that they've, you know.
Yeah.
It was Joe Kurtz's inimitable taste for fried gizzards introduced that to the show.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Extra source of protein. Right. Yeah. Probably not the healthiest source of protein, but.
They were delicious.
Yeah. I was interested by the discussion about the lighting of the different skin tones, because that is a challenge when you have a very white man next to a very dark black man. It's just, unfortunately, black skin does absorb light, so it's very hard, and then white skin reflects it. So from a lighting point of view, that becomes quite challenging with the way cameras sort of take all that information in. So I was really intrigued by some of the kind of techniques they used, and they would talk about the nightmare scenario would be Yafet Kotto standing next to Reed Diamond in a dark bar. Mm. Apparently was the thing that would lead to quite a lot of prep from their point of view. It was very interesting, all that.
Yeah, and that wasn't something they took lightly. You know, they took that seriously, were aware of it, and made sure that the lighting worked for everybody. Whereas I think I mentioned in the conversation, I think sometimes that even on a regular television show, everything's moving really fast, that people don't want to stop and take the extra care maybe for that.
Yeah, again, not wanting to name names, there's been one or two shows, especially very highly thought of shows in the past, that have made some terrible errors on that front. And obviously... there's been a lot of discussions over the years with more black filmmakers coming out who felt that, you know, black people in particular have not been photographed very well. And, you know, in many situations, they're correct. And I think the one thing Homicide, and I think you've said this before as well, Homicide did photograph black people really well. And you know, with a lovely multiracial cast there, I thought that the cinematography never lets the show down in that department at all.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting. And hopefully, Alex Zakshevsky, if you're out there listening, I need to contact you at some point. We can get Alex on, because I thought it was interesting that Josh and Joe talked about when Alex came on, he shot things a little darker. So you might have a key light, but then the fill light would be the ratio between the key light and the fill light, meaning the hot light on the actor and then the sort of softer light that fills the other side, would be, instead of being more in close proximity to each other, the key light would be hot, and then the fill side would be much darker. He liked a little more contrasty, maybe a little more dramatic. And I would love to talk to Alex about that, because that's a fairly major change in the way Josh lit the show, made things happen. So how he had to adjust himself and how they adjusted with that. And I think the kinos and stuff, you know, I always ask myself this question, can you dim a fluorescent? I think back then you could. At some point you couldn't dim a fluorescent. But, you know, they would have control. They would have control over that. One of the other things, speaking of dimmers, that was interesting was they talked about, and I remembered that, there was this monster dimmer board. It was probably a Mole Richardson dimmer board sitting in a corner somewhere off part of the set we didn't use, because they never used it. There was nowhere, you know, there weren't always, you know, you have a board like that on a set where you go in and you pop up all the normal lights you use, and then you adjust it for whatever the scene is. And you have all those lights in, you know, plugged into the dimmer board, and you control them all through that. And it was, I don't remember them ever using that. They might have So that was an interesting memory for me to think like, oh yeah, that thing that they use in traditional television filmmaking stuck in the corner, because what we're doing is so not traditional.
Brilliant. And it was interesting as well, I think it was Joe's comments about obviously the limitations of being in an actual building rather than on a set with floating walls out. So for people who've never been on a film set, basically you can remove a wall for the convenience of the camera, whilst obviously in a real location you can't do that, because you're dealing with the real brickwork and stuff. And there are pros and cons to both sides. It was really interesting. You know, the character of the building became so important to the show. And I think, again, that's one of the other wonderful things about Homicide. Using a real location gave it that sense of authenticity that you wouldn't get with, like, NYPD Blue. Right.
Yeah, and would a Baltimore, literally like a 8 foot wide, 10 foot wide, I mean, that was probably the norm, 8 foot or 10 foot wide Baltimore row house, feel the same if you'd built a set where you could take a wall out and step back past that 8 feet or 10 feet when they had to work within the confines of that. So then you are in that space, you are compacted in that space. And I think that, you know, that gives a feel. It also makes the tension. I think it made things, it raised the tension. If you have all these characters crammed into a small space that you can't escape from, right? Like, I couldn't escape from it. I have to think about how many times in places like that I have to find a place to hide after I bang the slate. You know, a lot of times it was like stepping around a corner or hiding behind a chair or... But in those tiny little, you know, houses, who knows, I might have handed it to Boots and he did it, and then I had to like go outside or something. Yeah, they were small spaces.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, or are you happy?
I don't think so. I think that whole can-do attitude that they talked about, I don't think they ever said no to Jean. I've been on shows where, you know, people say no to the cameraman or the director. They may have said no to directors on Homicide, but I don't think they ever said no to Jean, because I think that creativity and that excitement about being creative, they loved doing it. You know, it was fun. It was fun. And I think you get that sense from Josh and Joe that it was fun. Obviously, it was difficult. It was hard. You know, maybe we are only remembering all the happy stuff. But I think that was one of the really enjoyable aspects of the show for everybody.
Yeah, indeed. No, and again, they echoed the it was some of the most fulfilling time of their career. So, you know, I think it was Josh said he peaked high.
Right, he peaked too soon.
Whilst Joe claimed he never peaked at all, bless him.
Right, Joe said he'd yet... Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute, Josh. I've yet to peak. Right.
Oh, they were great, those guys. They were really great.
And interesting stories, too, to hear that I didn't know that Joe had started as a projectionist at the Smithsonian. I'd never heard that story before, so that was cool. And that Josh started, you know, as a PA. So it's interesting for people to hear out there that, you know, you can get in... So through different ways, there's a lot of different avenues to get into whatever field you're interested in. Just get your experience, you know?
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah. There's no one set way. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, Susan, thank you very much for your time today. I think that was a really, really interesting episode. And
yeah, it was a fun.
And everybody, thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that. And don't forget to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Threads, and Instagram. And we are just at Homicide Pod on all of those. And also you can check out our website, which is homicidelifeonthesets.com. And it's got links to our social media on there. And it's also got links to the episodes. And also, if you're enjoying this podcast, please do leave a review on the podcast app that you're listening on. All those reviews help juice the algorithm, which helps attract people to the episode. And also, please, if you're a Homicide fan, do share this among other fans and friends who enjoy the show, because obviously the more people who listen to this, the hopefully more likely the show might get streaming, because we would love to see Homicide on Netflix, Amazon, etc. And so, you know, we're hoping that by raising awareness of the show and getting a new conversation going about its importance, that we might well get it back, well, get it online and streaming. So there we go. Thank you very much, everybody.
Yes, let's state its stated goal that while we're still doing this podcast, we will then be able to start talking about watching it on a streaming platform. I assume Peacock, but whatever. Let's get it out there. Yes. Mm.
Whatever the platform, we want it out there. And I guess we'll try. Well, why don't we do a, if it does actually happen, let's do a live episode and do a watch along with some people.
Oh, that would be fun.
That'd be fun.
Oh, yeah.
We could do that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Woohoo.
Woohoo. There we go. There we go. And we'll have only fried gizzards allowed to be eaten.
Great. And one of our Baltimore beers, whatever one is left.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Cool. Right. Thank you, everybody. Take care.
Right. Thanks.